Welcome to the Garden of Eden. Dammy be asking the questions for the answers that you wanna hear. All you gotta do is sit back, grab a chair, or listen up while you clean and cook. Take a leaf from the creative's book. These gems open your mind and your heart. Okay, the show's gonna start. Welcome back, everyone, to the Garden of Eden podcast. And I'm excited to say that we've got a new format for this week's episode because it's a special one. Just a quick shout out to those who've been watching, liking, commenting on the podcast, on YouTube, on Spotify. Thank you so much for tuning in. And I hope you're enjoying the content that's coming out from this platform. There's plenty more to come. Make sure you subscribe on YouTube. Make sure you rate on Spotify. And yeah, hope you enjoy this episode. Going into this week's episode, I have a special guest with me, and it's special for many reasons, which we will dive into. But I want to welcome our guest, Miss Mojo, to the podcast. You'll probably notice something about Miss Mojo, which I will reveal in a little bit. But just to give you a bit more context on who she is and what she does, she is an entrepreneur, a business coach, an ACCA qualified accountant. So not no corner shop backstreet accountant. This is fully qualified at the top level. She's also a university lecturer at London South Bank Uni and also formerly at Coventry Uni London. She's a 2 times author of the Unleash Your Business Mojo book and Time Waster's Guide to Time Management. But the most important fact, which she's laughing about now because it is the most important fact, is that she is the mum to the greatest human in the world. So, mum, how are you doing today?
Wow, who was that for? Was that really me? Wow.
It was really
me. I'll take the accolade, definitely a mum, and I hope I've done half decent job of it. I think so. Looking at what the content you're putting out and looking at the son you've become, I can say, yeah, you're definitely my best son.
Best son, only one at that. But I wanted to say, and I know I said it a few days ago when we were talking before, but I think, yeah, as I get older, I realize, you know, how much it takes sometimes to, or how much parents have to think about all the different eventualities. And when you're a kid, you don't really understand some of the decisions that parents make. But as I've gotten older, I've come to appreciate the things that you did while I was younger that I didn't understand. I appreciate that, Mum. So thank you.
Thank you very much. And it's nice to hear that publicly said, because I don't think mums get the accolades, you know. No one gives us an award for being the best mom, but it's nice to hear that your children think you've done well, especially when they've gone into the world and seen how other children were brought up. So nice to hear that. Good feedback. Thanks.
Yeah. So to get started with the podcast this week, Mom, I wanted to take it back because I think it's always good to look back and see how the beginnings influence the people that we become later on in life. And I think you've got quite an interesting upbringing story. I mean, is it fair to say that you would class Nigeria as where you were brought up mostly? Would that be fair?
I'd say formative. So obviously I was, just like the Queen, I was born here. So it's a fact.
It's true, yeah.
So yeah, but my formative years were spent in Nigeria. So my teenage years actually, years were spent in Nigeria.
And looking back at that, how would you say those formative years in Nigeria influenced your decision later on in your career to then dive into business and become an entrepreneur? Were there any initial inspirations that you had when you started or that pushed you into starting your own business?
Definitely. So one of my earliest memories, so obviously I'm from a African household, and if you know anything about African households, the dad is the alpha and omega of the house. So obviously dad was, you couldn't do anything. In fact, you almost couldn't breathe without him. You were allowed to. So yeah. I think I was about 18. Then I went to do some work experience at his office, and my dad was still working for someone then. Mm. And I was actually shocked to find that my dad reported to someone. So I think in the office, he'd said yes or something to a higher manager. And yeah. In that moment, I told myself, you know what? I don't want to work for anybody. When I get old, I want to be my own boss. Like, how can my dad, who practically runs things, now be told what to do? So I think I told myself then that, yeah, whatever happens, when I get older, I would like to be in a position to run my own business. So I think that's one of the earliest things, memories that informed my decision to, you know, do it myself.
Yeah, I guess that is quite an encouragement. You see, you put granddad on a pedestal as the chief of the ogre of the household.
I know.
And then you go into the office and see him getting... Yeah, I can see why that's quite inspiring to go, yo, I don't want to be in this position myself. Mm. I do remember, actually, a few years ago, you told some stories about your own grandma that was an entrepreneur back in the early 1900s, which obviously
not quite. Are you talking about my grandma?
Yeah, your grandma. Okay, yeah.
She was born obviously in the 20s, but yeah. And if you, I don't know if you remember.
I don't know why I said early 1900s.
I know, you make it sound like, I know, everyone thinks that we're dinosaurs. Yeah. So I don't know if you remember, we had a play.
Yeah.
At the Barclay, and I actually recited it because she's also another inspiration. So there are lots of inspirations from my family, from ancestors, my grandma in particular, because as I said at the time when I recited it, she didn't go to school. I used to say she wasn't educated, but I think that's wrong, just because you don't go to school. That's a Western slant on it. So you don't need to go to school to be educated. Education is a lot wider than that. But anyway, she didn't go to school. However, she sold kola nuts. I actually have some in the house. So she sold kola nuts. These are things that are traditional to the Yoruba culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what I like about her is that she was married. And like I've said, I think I was watching a program on TV on Netflix the other day, and it was talking about how Yoruba women are actually encouraged to actually work. So most Yoruba women are not housewives. No.
Okay.
We're entrepreneurs, because obviously the man goes to the farm, but the woman has to sell the goods. And most of the time she would go to the marketplace. So my grandmother was one of that generation. So another thing about business is, so what is interesting about her story is that she started selling the kola nuts in front of the house, and she realized that she wasn't selling enough because obviously she wasn't within a community. So then she decided to go to a market. But when she got to the market, there were other traders there selling the same thing. And she thought, oh, it might be competition, but it's not, because what tends to happen is if you're looking for one thing and you know there is a place where you can get that, you're more likely to go there because there will be a concentration of similar traders there. So she was in the marketplace where she sold kola nuts. And one thing is, my grandma, before she left, she actually built 3 houses, and she was able to do that from selling kola nuts. So what she would do,
from
selling kola, 3 houses, So what she would do is she would ask how much it would cost maybe to do the foundation. They would tell her how much that would cost, and then she would go back to the market and start making money to meet that cost. Because remember, our grandparents didn't keep their money in the bank. Their money was kept under the bed or invested. So money was, savings weren't a thing. If you had money, you invested it in something. You didn't have money lying around as we do now. So so she also inspired me because she was a very strong woman. A lot of us have picked up some of her traits, and definitely she's someone I'm proud of. And the fact that she was born in the 20s, so I'm talking about when she started her business, probably in the 1940s. So and she was and it's funny because as we've grown older now, obviously I'm 5'9". My grandma was actually only about 5'4", 5'5". But because of the kind of power, authority she wielded, I actually used to think she was 6'4". You
know? My growth gang, quick interruption. Thank you for watching this week's episode of the podcast. Remember, if you like the episodes, like and subscribe on YouTube and go follow on Spotify or the other audio platforms that you listen to this podcast on. Most importantly though, if you know someone who can get value from this episode, click that little share button at the bottom and go send it to them so they can check out this good shit. Thanks again. Back to the show. It's funny that. I know. It's funny, yeah. When people command such authority with their presence,
yes,
and the way they speak, the confidence they speak with, it adds a lot of inches to their height.
I know.
In a weird way, you kind of revere them as bigger than they are. It's like when you see when people talk about celebrities that they meet in person,
yeah,
and they believe because of the stature they have, either on social media, yeah, on TV or in films, that they're gonna be this big person, and then they see them in person, like, wow, you're a lot shorter than I thought. But it's because of the weight that their celebrity or their authority or how people put them on a pedestal,
yeah,
makes them seem as if they're gonna be taller. So yeah, I can yeah, imagine.
I remember growing up, I think the only person my dad respected, I wouldn't say feared, but respected, was my grandma. You knew when she came to the house that no one was getting beat. Nobody was getting beaten because she would not allow anybody else. And yeah, my dad didn't care. But yeah, once she came, grandma, no one was getting touched.
Mm.
Yeah.
So moving forward from the inspiration. So, right, you have your grandma, you have seen that situation with granddad in the office, you know, being told what to do and internalizing that as a motivation not to be in the same situation. So obviously you did start your career as an employee, so you went to university, got your degree, and then qualified as an accountant and started working in the professional world as an accountant. And then at the time you started your business, you were obviously at the time a single parent, so looking after two kids on your own, managing a mortgage on top of that. So what were the challenges you faced when you did start your business at that point in time? Because for a lot of people, they might be in that similar situation and think, you know what, I've just got to manage these things on my own and just deal with this as it is, because if I try and start a business, it's going to be too risky, or am I going to have too much on my plate, etc., etc. A lot of these kind of fears might pop up. So for you, how did you overcome them? And then when the challenges came through, how did you ride those challenges in that context?
Okay, so that's a, what will I say? That's a very packed question. So there are lots of elements to that question. So I'll start by saying, because you said the inspiration why I started, but obviously a lot of issues here. We're in a culture that's different from ours. And then sometimes you go to work and things don't pan out the way you want them to. And sometimes you get bored of work. I'm somebody who likes to do different things, different times. And I had wanted to leave the job. Obviously, things happened. And it was a perfect moment for me to leave. So when I left, and going back as well, accountancy was not actually something I chose. It was just something I heard people speaking about. And I thought, you know what? I'm good for that. I'll do accounting. So when I left work, the first thing that was the easiest thing for me to do was to become an accountant. So I set up the practice. I would say that I've taken risks, so I'm not too scared about changing things. I love change. I love challenges. So, and I knew it would be a challenge. So I remember, I think you were going...
What do you love about change?
I just don't like things being too predictable. I like... adventures, challenges, just doing different things. I get bored. I think my boredom threshold is quite
It's quite
low.
Yeah, I mean, the reason I'm asking is because obviously accountancy is a very framework,
I know,
model based. Do X, get Y, structure, put it in Z format. So it's interesting that you went that way, despite deep down knowing that actually.
Yeah, well, you know how it is. You're African. When you're African Asian, it's always accountant, lawyer, doctor,
engineer. Yeah. That's what that one's for me.
Yeah. So there's all these professions. So at that time, you thought, to be honest, over the, I wish I were born in this day and age. It was common: graphic designer, digital marketer, affiliate marketing, all these website designer. Those were not jobs that we could aspire to. Do you imagine telling your mom or your dad? Anyway, there was no YouTube then, but now YouTube is a thing. You could be a YouTuber, make good money. So anyway, back to my story. So I'm not scared of challenges. So yeah, started the business, registered it. At the time, it was as a chartered accountant. So business rolling on. I made a few mistakes, and obviously I've got my own YouTube channel as well, and I've talked about those mistakes.
Make sure you plug it.
Unleash Your Business Mojo is my YouTube channel. Yeah, so what I was going to say is that when I started the business, oh, come on, I made mistakes. Got a business plan together. That took me a long time. So I was trying to work out the 50-page business plan. But in the meantime, I started going to networking events. And when you go to a network event, it's talking about your business. So I was that chick with a handful of business cards, just, you know, throwing it around the room. Anybody would catch it. Those were some mistakes. So I was not talking about what I did. And I think part of that is because I wasn't enjoying accounting. I was just doing it because, hey, it's what I knew how to do.
This is where I'm at now.
Yeah. So throwing the cards, I didn't have a focus or a niche. I don't know if you know about niches. So for instance, if you want to be an accountant, you can't be an accountant to all trades. You can choose. You want to be an accountant for lawyers. You want to be an accountant for IT businesses. You want to be an accountant for care homes. Mm-hmm. So it's good if you actually, if you niche it down, so then you gain a better, deeper experience of the challenges these businesses face. You are able to help them. I was just anybody's accountant, sole trader, limited company, anything. So I was just spreading myself too thin. And another thing is, when you first start as an accountant, I was going to say back in the day, this isn't too far ago, so we're talking the early 2000s, there weren't that many softwares around as there are now. So most of my clients came with their Tesco bag. And when I say Tesco bag of receipts. Because people paid for things in cash and all that. So you get a Tesco bag and it'll be full of receipts from any old period.
And statements and all that.
So the receipts were the worst ones, because you'd have to, the first thing is you'd have to arrange them in date order, put them together, month and all that, and then post them on Excel spreadsheet or software if you wanted to, but it was just too much. And anybody, I hate admin. I hate those mundane.
Yeah.
You know, it's all structure.
So you have to comb through all that detail
stuff. So that was a lot. So I think initially that put me off. But what I do like about accounting, though, the part I do like, once all the figures are on there, I'm the kind of person who will go and make sure the balances are correct. So if I'm looking at statements, and I do review a lot of financial statements now, so I like to review the statements, but I just don't like all the work that goes into it. So anyway, I started the business. Then the recession, I don't know if you know about
this. I was going to talk about this in another, question.
So I can leave that. But anyway, that happened. And overnight, of course, business went.
Well, we can go into it now, actually, because one of the things that I hear, obviously, you know me, I like listening to Gary Vee a lot. And he always talks about when people get punched in the face by the economy. And he's saying that for my generation, we haven't really felt it. And then obviously the pandemic comes along and that's one form of it. But for yourself, I remember actually, because I was young, but I wasn't too young to not know what was going on.
Yeah.
I remember 2008, the recession hit.
Recession hit,
and
man.
That was when business was going quite well for you. Business was going quite well for you. And then the recession comes. And for many people who started the entrepreneurial journey in the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years, they haven't had to face anything until now. So it would be good to hear how you rode that challenge of being punched in the face by the economy, where literally everything goes to zero, or everything just falls apart, and you have to build things back up.
So the recession came, and of course most of my clients were ethnic, were small business owners themselves, and they saw a change in their business. So it affected their business and ultimately affected mine. So I had to go back to the drawing board. Now, when I started doing the accounting, I realized I was more interested in what happens behind the business. So people always do the account. So most people who came to me as well, they came because of compliance. They needed to submit their accounts to the HMRC, that's the tax office, and they needed me to put the figures together. One thing that they didn't look at, though, is planning for the business, because by the time I prepared the figures, it was too late. It was a year after anyway. So those figures meant nothing for them. What they should have been focusing on, rather, was their business plan and setting shorter goals around their businesses, concentrating on maybe their niche marketing, which I failed at when I started my business, because remember I told you I was just speaking to everyone, whereas it's good for you to identify a niche, a target audience that you want to sell your products or services to. So I went back to the drawing board and started reading that, because that was something I actually enjoyed. So all through my accounting courses, I liked the business. We did business admin, marketing, strategy, and those are the things I enjoyed. So during that time, like I said, so I started looking more into those things. I started talking to a few of the clients who were left about that. So I decided to change the business. And as I was thinking, I went on Facebook one day and there was an advert for me to be part of a panel, a bit like Dragon's Den, where we'll be assessing business plans, cash flow statements to see whether, because I was part of a company that was actually lending money. So this was just after the recession and they were looking to lend money to those who wanted to start up their business. So this is part of the government trying to put some money back into the economy.
Right,
I was part of this outfit that was looking at business plans to see if the business was viable enough for them to get the money and run the business. And I loved it so much. And the feedback I got from the clients, I would ask them, show them how to tweak their accounts and how to tweak their business plan. So they actually loved it. And then I learned a few lessons from that. One was most of these business plans were not actually prepared by the person submitting the plan. They'd got someone else to do it. That was interesting. Okay. Yeah, whoa, that was one. The second one was the business plans were too long. And we all know, if you've ever had a business plan, you know that if it's too long, no one's going to do anything with it. You just put it in a cupboard, collect dust, and you probably, if you're going to the bank to get some money, you might bring it up, but you don't use it to run your business. So then I, based on those two facts, I then developed something called a one-page business map. And this actually shows you the basic steps you need to get started, because I think it was Richard Branson, don't quote me on that, once said that if you can't write your business idea and the steps on one page, then you're not ready to start a business yet. So it's all one page, just about your vision, your first few steps, like I've said, your target audience, your own SWOT, what are you good at, what is it you might need help with?
Yeah.
Just identifying that on one page, and then for the first 3 months, concentrating on the key things you need to do. So I did that, and then I developed a program around that where I was actually coaching women mainly who wanted to go into business, coaching them to help them do that startup plan, and everything was based around the business plan. And I think around then as well, I was doing courses at our local enterprise center, and I was also hosting a women's networking event. So I used to do that every couple of weeks, brought women, a lot of women together who were able to collaborate and grow their businesses. And that's something I did do. Forgot that.
So that pivot, because I think the what would be interesting to hear is how, like, in those pivoting moments, how you were still able to ride the challenge in the sense of emotionally, with the difficulty obviously of entering a recession, how you spot those opportunities. Was, because I guess you've explained how it happened.
Yeah.
Was it intentional though, or was it more opportunistic in?
I think part of it was part of a journey I wanted to take. And then you're talking about how I was able to handle those challenges. Okay, so in the recession, before the recession, up to 2006, 2007, I used to sit there, watch Sky News back to back. One day in 2007, I think Northern Rock was the bank going down then.
Yeah.
And every day on the news. And I made a conscious decision then. This was 2007 when the crunch recession was hitting hard. I made a decision to never ever watch Sky News. And I can count the number of times I've watched any live news on my one hand. So I think that helped me. That helped me keep my mental peace. And I did the same through the pandemic. So I never ever watched a news story during the pandemic. So people ask me how you managed to keep your sanity. That's one.
Yeah, watching the news is a dangerous one. Like, I remember when you did that, and I borrowed from that and did the same thing. And even now, like, I've spoke to some people during the pandemic, like people that I've met through social or whatever, and you know, they were talking about, I had to stop watching the news because it was making it seem like doomsday, because it's crazy. I think Brian Rose from London Real, he had someone on from maybe the BBC or one of the news stations, and he said that in this interview with this guy, the guy's like, at the news stations, every day is Halloween because they're looking for a way to scare people. Like, it's part of the business model. They're looking for ways to scare people so that it puts them in a state of fear and keeps them glued, because they're like, what do we do next? And it invokes an emotional response that keeps them glued to the news because they want to find a resolution to this stuff. And then I guess you could get deeper into if there's negativity and people are scared, then they're easier to control. But that, and that's be a conspiracy. But anyway, going back to your point, it was a good decision you made.
Excellent. Yeah. And it's funny because when I made that decision, I didn't get it from anywhere. I just thought, you know what? For my own peace of mind, I need to stop watching the news because everything was breaking news. And it's the same news breaking a million times a day. And every time it breaks, you're like, what is next? Yeah. But here we are today. Yeah. I'm still alive, like 15 years late. Yeah. So, and I think stepping up, and because as people have said it, and if you guys take one thing, because I don't know the age, if you take one thing away, if the news item is that important, you'll find out about it. I'm a lecturer and I keep up to date with the news, but I can read the news. When I read the news, it's one time and you're gone. But on the news, like you said, it's their business model. They want people to be glued down. People, bad news travels fast. People love bad news. I don't know, maybe it makes people feel good. But anyway, not watching the news meant back, I could take back my time. There was no fear, no worry. So and when you have no fear, no worry, you can focus on what you need to do. So that allowed me to focus. So I think that is one thing that it allowed me to do. So no news. And so that was one thing. And then the challenges, of course, everybody was going through challenges. So it's just take one day at a time. I also believe very much in a vision board. So I use a vision board. And this is where I try to just put my thoughts on paper using visuals and just looking at it every day and believing it would happen. And I think, like I said, the advert that came on Facebook, I think that was one way of my vision becoming a reality, because that changed my life, to be honest. It changed my life because it was enabled me to move into this business coaching side of things, and which it's changed my life.
Yeah.
Really. It changed my life.
Another pathway. Opened
another door. I don't know if there's any, did I cover everything in the question?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, thanks, man. Well, I actually didn't know some of the stuff like that you saw something on Facebook, and that's what took you in that direction. No, it's interesting to hear these stories because I guess this is all, especially with me being your son, like all happening in the background, and like you don't know the journey that your mum's going on. So one of the skills that I think is really impressive about you, mum, is your ability to do public speaking, if that's the way you say it. But your public speaking ability is impressive, and I've thought that for a long time, and it's something that I know I need to start improving and working on, because I think it's an essential skill. Would you say it's something that is necessary for entrepreneurs of today, even with this ability to speak via your phone and through social media? Do you think it's essential for them? And it would be good to hear how it's benefited you in your career, because I think it would just be good to hear how specifically it's benefited you, because I think it's, I think it's an essential skill.
Yeah, public speaking is very important. I remember, I'll quickly take you back to one story. So when I was in Nigeria, I think we had a module, and for that module, it required us to get up and speak. And I need to take you back to an earlier experience. So when I was in class three, that would be form three, was form three, is that year nine? Year nine, so, we did a debate. And I thought I'd prepared for the debate, and I got up to speak. And just as it is now, it was silence. Nothing came. I think I said a few couple of words and then it was silent.
Mm.
And I vowed to myself on that day that I would never ever get up and speak in public. So fast forward a few,
Because the experience was
bad. I just blanked out.
Wow, that's a surprise considering where you are now. But
And I told myself, I'll never again. So a few years later, like I said, taking this module, and part of it was, I think 10% or 20% of those 100 marks, 20% of that required me to get up and speak in front of the class. And I told the lecturer that's not going to happen. Just take it, mark me out of 80, because there's no way I'm going to get up and speak.
So you were really willing to just sacrifice the whole, whole mark.
Yeah.
Damn.
Because of the experience, it was a horrible experience. Yeah. So, and then, how did I change? So I came to London, and I know I love speaking. Anybody who knows me know I can speak all night long. I love speaking. I thought to myself, not being able to speak in public is actually holding me back, and I need to develop that skill. Because so training for me is easy. So training, because even though I didn't have the public speaking ability, I was training, but training for me is easy because you've got something to hold on to and you're training. But I wanted the ability to be able to speak in front of larger audiences. So found out, I don't even know how I found out about it. I think it was a dear friend of me who mentioned Toastmasters. So there I was, I went all the way to Croydon, which is almost like in another continent. Went there, enjoyed it so much. But then you guys were very young and it required commitment of once every 2 weeks, and it was always in the evening. So you guys were young, so I couldn't join at the time I wanted to. But once you got older, I did join one and I loved it. I loved it. Became a vice chair of education. So what it teaches, and anybody out there, if you get an opportunity to join Toastmasters, I think they do a lot of their stuff online now, which is a shame, because being able to speak in public, face-to-face, in person, is a great skill to have. So Toastmasters, learn how to speak with Toastmasters. You've been to Toastmasters and you won awards there.
Awards is a strong, I'd say more the table topics. I've won a couple of those from going before. But obviously, I see other speakers and I understand the levels of difference, and they're really in their flow. But go on. So Toastmasters. So for anyone who doesn't know, Toastmasters is an international public speaking group that you can join. Organization. Sorry, you can explain that.
It's funny, you know, Toastmasters started in America. I don't know how many years ago, but quite a long time ago. It was through a recession as well. And they found out that one of the best skills that you can possess as anyone looking for a new job is to the ability to speak in public. So that's why this organization was set up. So what it does is that you go in there, when you first get there, you're given a bunch of 10 speeches that you have to do over a period of time. So you choose when you want to. But each evening when you go there, each evening when you go there, you get involved in the process. So it's more like a group. So they have grammarians. So you come up with a word of the day. Like you said, table topics. I love table topics because you'd have to prepare something and then you just put your hand in a box and come up with something that you need to talk about on the spot. So you don't know about the topic. They just might say, talk about the best holiday you've had. And then you have to get up and talk about that. So whoever does the best on that day wins. So it's just put it almost like, you know, throwing you in the spotlight and getting you to speak. So we have prepared speeches. And I don't know if you remember because there's speeches we practice for. I used to use teddy bears in the sitting room. So I'll put teddy bears. So I'll get you to sit down and put teddy bears there and try. Practice. So it's about practicing to speak.
I can't even remember. That sounds. I probably did, but.
Yeah, you can remember. It's okay. Remember, so I'll put teddy bears in the sitting room and then do my practice over and over again. So when we got there, because you were judged. So, of course, you're allowed to use paper to reference, but it's good if you don't hold any add memoirs to, and then you get better. So you go through your 10 speeches and you do these speeches in front of a fair bit of people, and what they do is they give you feedback. So each person who listens to you speak will give you feedback. Now I never used to speak like this. I was a very, very fast speaker, very fast. So part of going to Toastmasters allowed me to slow down my speech, try to introduce pauses, which I'm still working on, because Toastmasters is so that's what helps me to develop my public speaking. So training became easy for me to speak in front of any number of people. So I can get up and being a lecturer, sometimes you can walk into an auditorium of over 100 students, but because you have that, I don't have that fear. And obviously when you're speaking in public as well, preparation is key. As once you prepare and you understand exactly what you're going to talk about,
lean on the principles of public speaking once you know what your, your content area is.
It's not easy though, because I think public speaking, they did a survey once, I don't know how true this is, that people would rather be buried alive than get up and speak in front of others. Yeah. And I get a lot of my students as well, and I tell them, luckily enough at South Bank now, we actually have a branch of Toastmasters. So, oh, okay. Yeah, we do. Yeah. I think it's excellent because you develop team working skills, being able to speak in public, and being able to speak in public gives you confidence. Mm-hmm. You know how many best men drink before they speak because they find it very difficult. And there are actually speaking coaches online who actually train best men on how to give the best man's speech because
it's a tough one. I think communicating ideas is one that I've come to realize is powerful. And I think when you're given, it's almost like when you're given the mic and the stage, people just take in what you're saying. If they're willing to take, if they're open to hearing a message, and you're able to communicate effectively, they're taking that in on a different level than maybe even sometimes if you're speaking to them one-on-one in some cases.
Yeah.
Because there's the added respect of them putting you on the pedestal. Wow, this person's on stage and they're doing their thing. So yeah.
It's good. And public speaking has definitely benefited me. Definitely. You need it. In the job I do, our voices are our currency.
Yeah.
So, and you need to be able to speak.
Go on, Mom.
Yeah. So any more about the...
No, I think what would be interesting, because you've alluded to it a few times now, and obviously at the start of the podcast, I mentioned that you're a university lecturer. And I think what I found so interesting about your career is your ability to pivot into loads of different endeavors and do really well within them. And also finding opportunities where other people may just not take or not even seek those opportunities. So I think hearing about the story of you becoming a lecturer, because I guess a lot of people have this idea that, you know, you need to go to uni and then do the degree, and then you need to do a master's, and then you need to do a PhD, and then you need to do research, and like you need to be super embedded into the education system for that to be possible, like super embedded into the institute for that to be possible. So it would be interesting to hear your story to see how maybe that idea might not quite be the why people shouldn't necessarily block themselves from being lecturers if they haven't followed that path. So
so that's an interesting one. Thanks for asking me that question, because up until I became a university lecturer, I was how can I say, looking to be a college lecturer, because I knew I loved training and I really wanted to get into academics, but I didn't get that opportunity. But what I will say, because I've often said, oh, I'm lucky, but I'm not, because obviously I do have an education. I'm FCCA qualified. I've got now I've got the PGC, and I've done other certifications as well. I have a degree and all that. So I don't have a PhD yet. So my journey is different. Is different. One thing I love is networking. So I've actually been called the queen of networking. So this getting the lecturer position was due to my insistence and also the ability to network well, because you just never know where you might need anybody, these people. So very quickly, when I wrote my first book, so this is interesting, because when I wrote this book, I wrote it in about 30 days. I wrote it in a month. And like I said, I went to South Bank. So South Bank, when I applied, when I went to South Bank, all I really wanted to do was go to the Alumni Association and tell them or ask them for an opportunity for me to talk to the other members about my book. And I was able to write in 28 days, and what inspired me to write it and what it's about. So this is obviously a book for those who wanted to start and run their own business. So you were working with me at the time, do you not remember? Yeah. So I sent the first email, and I heard nothing. And I just got an autoresponder saying, oh, within 30 days, they'll get back to me and let me know what's what. And then 30 days
easy thing to just let happen, right? Autoresponding, you're like, well, that's it then.
No. So 30 days later, I think about 30 days later, I was just looking at my emails and I saw, oh, these guys have not gotten back to me yet. So I shoot another email off to say, hey guys, you said you're going to get back, still waiting, what's up? And then I just get an email saying, oh, the dean. No, not the dean then, she was Desi. So she's now the dean. So she's just got an, I just got an email from her saying, oh, I love your profile. And then another thing I did is I LinkedIn upon my LinkedIn profile. And on my LinkedIn profile, I listed most things about myself. And obviously, I had won an award as well, Chambers of Commerce Award. So I sent a link. So she just emailed me back and said, listen, you know what? I like your profile. I like the fact that you've written a book. Do you want to come in so we can have a chat? So long story short, went in there, had a chat. She liked me. She said, oh, I'd like you to come and do some teaching with our students. And I, at that time, I just thought, oh, yeah, something basic, maybe get a bunch of students together and talk to them about starting a business. And then what do I get? I just get an email with a descriptor asking me to teach MBA students entrepreneurship. Oh, yeah. So that was my first in.
Yeah.
To be honest.
I remember this, yeah.
And my heart was palpitating. Everything. When I got the email and I saw it, I thought, yeah, this is it. I'm going to be be detected. I'm going to be found out. They'll find out that I'm a fraud.
The imposter syndrome.
I know the imposter syndrome was really sad. The imposter syndrome. NBA.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a real thing. Yeah.
So that's how I went and did the first. And the students loved me. I got a lot of feedback. They liked it so much that there was another cohort, and they called me and said, yeah, they want me to do that course. And I did the other course. But it didn't come with without its own challenges, because I put myself under a lot of pressure. The imposter syndrome that you think about. I started getting heart palpitations. You know, I actually thought there was a problem with me. So I went to the doctor. And they tested me. They put monitors on me and all that. And I thought, there's something wrong. And guess what? We went, because I was teaching them. The first court, the second court was around May, June. And in July, I just noticed I felt okay. So it was all the anxiety and the pressure.
Around teaching rather than actually. It's funny though how these stresses actually manifest in the body as something.
I know.
And trying to tell you something's up. But it's just because of the way you thought about. Because I'm sure now those don't manifest at all now. So
no, because I know how to handle, and I'm obviously strong. But then I was just thrown in at the deep end. I had to develop a lot of material myself and all that. So, you know, and going into university, I'd never taught at university, so I was still, you know, feeling my way through. But I'm still there 5 years later, so must be doing something good. And I've got added qualifications on top of that. So
Yeah,
so that was
it's
how
very,
I...
It's very, like, I have to rate it, Mom, seriously, because there's a lot of ways that you could have blocked yourself. A lot of people don't even send the second email.
I know.
A lot of people don't send the second email after the first one. They're just like, well,
yeah, it looks like, done. No. I like to push, and I guess it depends as well. And then, and at the time I go into South Bank, so... Coventry University as well, because I worked with them as well. And that was an interesting one as well, because I'm a part of the Chamber of Commerce. And I just got an email to say, oh, by the way, we're having an event. And I looked at those who were attending, and the Vice Chancellor of Coventry was going to be there. So I thought, you know what? Yeah, I've got this. And because I teach networking, on top of being a lecturer, I also teach small businesses on these key business skills. And one of them I teach is networking. So... And when you're networking, when you're going to any event, you must have a plan. You must know why you're going there. You can't just get up and go to an event just because maybe you have time on your hands. You have to be strategic. So, saw that he would be speaking at the event. So, I took a copy of my book. I knew exactly when I was going to approach him, knew what I was going to say.
Yeah.
So, went there, just performed my plan. And obviously, he's the vice chancellor, introduced me to somebody else. And the person he introduced me to was also very busy. So it took a few months for it to materialize. But I kept on sending him an email. And I always acknowledge, and this is another thing, you need to appreciate other people's time. So I always used to acknowledge that, listen, I know you're very busy. Just to remind you that if you need any help, I'm available. And one of those emails, he just called me and said, yeah, we need you to come in and do 4 hours. By the time I left, they'd given me like how many hours a week? Probably about 20-something hours a week.
Of lecturing time.
Of lecturing time. Because Yeah, because you have to have a passion about things. Obviously, I do enjoy the teaching, and that's about. It's just the importance of networking, knowing where to go, who to speak to, approaching them at the right time, trying to keep in touch without being a, you know, being a what?
Being intrusive. I think is
that's a nice word. Intrusive, was, like being another
That has just got me thinking, actually, because. You're very good at networking, actually, and keeping tabs with those people that you've connected with. Because I'm thinking about it for myself. Like I would love to be a better networker. And I think when I see people in person regularly, I'm good at, you know, relating and building those relationships and seeing people. But when it's offline, online, sorry, and away from the in person, I can definitely improve. And just hearing that, I'm thinking, wow. How many opportunities are people missing out on because they're not keeping tabs with the people that are in their network or that have come close to their network, and just that regular touch point keeps them in the loop.
It's important.
Another thing that you alluded to, actually, which I wanted to talk about, as somebody who's still trying to finish a book. So... Everyone who listens to this podcast knows that I'm in the stages of finishing my own novel at the moment, which has taken a god-awful long time to finish. Because, as I've told you off camera, off the podcast, like there's been a lot of moving parts with that and sorting different editors out, etc., etc. But you have written two books, Mum, which is super impressive. Like, so many people want to write a book, but they just don't, and they never get around to ever doing it. So the fact you've done two is sick. One of the things that is also very interesting about your book writing journey, though, is the fact that with your first book, Unleash Your Business Mojo, which I'm just going to show everyone here. Yeah, come on, gotta plug my mum. You wrote that in 30 days.
Yeah.
So... I want to ask you about the book writing process for the second book too. But first off, with this book that you wrote in 30 days, how did you do it in 30 days? Because how many words is it again? Something like...
It's about 26,000.
Yeah. I mean, most people have to do that many words for their dissertation or for essays at uni. They ain't finishing that in 30 days, that many words. So please...
Another secret, though, I actually did 50,000 in 30 days. So I actually had to cut it down. So there's something called NaNoWriMo. I don't know if you've heard of NaNoWriMo. So it's a monthly competition. I heard about it probably in 2011 or 10. So I did it for the first time then. And then when I wanted to write the book, I knew. Because if I decided to write it any which way, I probably would not be motivated. So I purposely entered the competition. So the competition is actually for... fictional writers. Most of the writers are fictional. But I thought, you know what? If I don't enter this competition, so the competition is normally in November. So 1st to the 30th of November, and you're supposed to, well, you need to write about 1,667 words every day for 30 days. So I decided when I was writing this first one that, the best time of the night for me, because I was running my own business then, the best time of the day is at night. So I'll get into bed at 10 o'clock, and I'm also a touch typist. Right, so I'll type.
What does that mean?
It means that I don't need to look for the keys when I'm typing. Oh, I can just type without looking at the keyboard. Right.
People still look at the keyboard when they type?
Because remember, computers to us was introduced, but you guys were probably digital natives. So when you type, you don't look at the keyboard.
Almost. I think the generation below, because they're born into that stuff. They're like, they can't even imagine in a world where it doesn't exist, but. So
as a touch typist, in fact, it's funny, you know, because I remember in secondary school, in Form 3, which is year 9, we were taught how to type. I could never, because the typewriters then we used needed a lot of force.
Right.
So they weren't like these touch. So anyway, so I could type very fast. So I get into bed at 10, spent an hour typing. The 1,600 word, 1,667 words
every
day until I got to 50,000 words, and then of course at the end at the end of the month, I had to edit it down to 26,000. And it's funny because when I wrote the book, I sent it when I sent it to my editor. Imposter syndrome is bad. You know, I sent it to my editor. I waited and waited for her to get back to me. I think it took about 2 or 3 weeks. And what I thought she would say is that, you know what, Mojo, please take this advice.
Never write again.
No, you know,
don't even bother. Just put it in the bin, delete it, and just think of something else. Yeah, that's the.
So I was expecting to come and say, you know, I'm really sorry to break it to you, but I don't think you. Don't waste your time writing. It's not for you, right? Mm. You're writing. We'll never be pals.
Yeah.
Instead, she came back and said, "Wow, I love the way you write. Even though we never met, da da da." She said all this. I was like, "What?"
Mm.
So that's, that was great. The feedback was great. So then she just went through a bit of the editing. And then I released the book in 2016. And you were there.
Yes, I was at the book launch.
And people have got very good feedback. It's on Amazon, and I've got good feedback on Amazon. My students buy the book as well. Excuse me. Water break. Yeah, so I'm proud of the book. And my late dad, when he got his copy as well, he actually called me, and he was very proud of me.
Mm.
It was nice. So I'm happy with the book. Yeah, so that was the first one. That was I wouldn't say easy. I've likened writing a book to being pregnant. So you write the book out of the way, and then the 9 months, it takes about 9 months to actually get the book from the draft content to final product. It took me about 9 months. The book stressed me out as well, because I went ahead and set a launch date without the book even being ready. Because I didn't even have a cover. It wasn't edited. It wasn't set. Oh, it was crazy. In fact, there were so many times I wanted to change the date, but I thought to myself, it didn't matter. If I move the date to Jan instead of September, I'll still have the same issues, and it will still be something I'd have to work with. So I decided to just go back. I put myself under a lot of stress.
I remember when I was in I think I was in Prague or no I was in Zagreb in Croatia when I was interrailing. I remember you were calling me about suppliers and getting the book printed, and I was like, I wish I could help, but I'm on holiday. So you got it done. I remember at that time you were stressing. I think it was probably a month or 5 weeks to go, and I remember that things were
at one point I actually started designing the cover, because the cover that came through was just not it. I had the cover done again though, so I'm actually going to change this cover. So the cover that I released it with was not something I wanted, but at the time it's what all I had. So that was good. And then through my networking as well, I actually forgot this. I was talking about something the other week, because I used to do some work with the Barbican, and they put two of their staff members, they donated two of their staff members.
This is because this is something that's come up a few times, you mentioned in networking. And just if you could quickly, what is your strategy for that? Because it sounds like you have a game plan. It's not just something you're sporadically doing. It's like you identify something that makes you then go, right, I'm going into networking mode, and I'm gonna build these connections because of something. What is the?
I think naturally, I don't know if I have a game plan, but I like meeting people. I like talking to people. I like finding out more about them. So how I actually found out about the Barbican, because they were looking for a community liaison, or they wanted to take essentially more people to the Barbican, because they found out there wasn't a good representation of people in the borough. So I was also a member of the Women's Institute then. Yes, I don't know if you know Women's Institute. So Women's Institute is predominantly Caucasian.
Right.
It's for the middle class. Why? Well, I wanted to be part of that. So for some reason, I've always wanted to be part of that. And I applied, became one of them, even became the vice president and did a lot of their PR. So it was while I was a member of that group, I think the email came from the Barbican, and I saw it and I thought, this would be an interesting thing to be part of. So don't know how we get into. So that was networking. So the Barbican job as well that I did came from the WI. And because of the work I did with the Barbican, they were impressed. And when I told them I was launching my book, they actually sent two of the staff members there to help me, you know, with the night. So they were the ones actually collecting the money from the sales.
Those
two ladies, remember?
Oh my days, they were from the Bible. I do remember.
Part of now, and I think and because I did a good job with them, because we took two coaches to the Barbican, you know, of people. Because we had some festivals. We also had a festival at Walthamstow as well. So I was one of the leaders of the group. Networking. So you're asking about networking. I think sometimes it's intentional. Mm-hmm. So definitely intentional. Others, it's just maybe something I just do naturally. Mm-hmm. And I'm always sometimes in the right place, right time. And I also like connecting people. So if you come to me and you have an issue, I always like to be able to hook you up with somebody who might be able to help you. So I like connecting people as well.
Yeah, definitely.
And I always know where. In fact, sometimes people will call me from Nigeria and say, oh, they need this. And I'll say, oh, yeah, this person can help me. And they will think, what? You live here? I live in Nigeria. So I'll get people calling me from Nigeria asking for things. In fact, this morning we're having a conversation because we needed some police officers. And I told them, now, listen, I've got a cousin. You know, I don't know if I said, I've got a cousin. Don't. Okay, don't worry. Yeah. Just, yeah. No, because you have a cousin you speak to on Facebook.
Oh, Omotoyosi.
Yeah, so So his uncle, my cousin, obviously works for the military. So I was telling him, oh yeah, I think I've got somebody I might. So I'm always trying to. I just love being a resource.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that helps me network as well. So I love being a resource. I love people coming to me and say, oh yeah, I need this, and me being able to help. I love that.
Yeah, extremely valuable the networking one.
Because remember your passport.
Yeah, passport. You helped me out a lot with that, so thanks for that.
So,
hopefully, well, I don't even know if I should be talking about other passports on this, because British government might be like, "Hey, you've got another one." No, just my British passport.
Yeah.
But anyway,
but it's just knowing where to go.
Yeah, those people are seen as very valuable. I know the people in my life that, like, shout out to Gabe. You know who you are. He's a connect to a different degree, and I see how it affects your career, and that's just for anybody listening to this. I guess if you're able to be someone that can connect dots with people, I mean, doesn't even have to be regularly, but seem to be trying to help people find the right people for them to work with, it's always remembered, and people really appreciate it and will probably want to work with you more because you've helped them out, especially if they have a good experience.
Yes,
that's an important caveat. But so that was Unleash Your Business Mojo, that book. In terms of your second book now, so I'm going to hold it up. So this is the second one. My mum's most recent book, The Time Waster's Guide to Time Management. So this book was released late 2021.
Yeah.
And if I'm not mistaken, the process in writing this book was a little bit different.
Yes.
One of the things I think would be interesting that is one of the chapters that you wrote, which is about the Pareto law.
Oh, okay.
And it talks about you know, what activities. Well, actually, to give a bit more context, so Pareto's law is a natural law that you find in sciences pretty much everywhere across the globe, and in engineering it was also quite a big thing that we studied, and essentially. There's an 80-20 law in nature that happens. So if you have a distribution of two different types, you usually have an 80-20 distribution. So 80% of the people will be within an average height, and then the other 20% will be on one end of the spectrum or the other. Or if we take it into activities that you do, 80% of the activities you do lead to 20% of the results, but there's a 20% of there's a 20% portion of activities that you do that contribute to the far large majority of the results you get, i.e. 80%. Yes. So what 80-20 principles did you use when writing this book for yourself?
Because
that would be interesting to hear.
Okay, so I knew you were going to ask me something like that, and I'm going to read this paragraph here out from the book, because it's writing the book was not as easy as that, because I was lecturing and at two universities at the time, preparing notes, resources, that time. So I didn't have as much free time as I had when
so
I wrote
the
first.
So you were writing a book for yourself, in essence, because needed to manage your own time.
So this is what... and I'll read from this paragraph. I've been intending to write this book for months. Why am I actually doing it now? Is it because I finally found some uncommitted time? Wrong. I have assignments to grade, emails to send, new models and courses to develop, and overdue library books to finish reading. I'm working on this book now as a way of not doing those things. So the book is actually a form of procrastination. I don't know if that was understood yet.
Yeah.
So,
Because
it wasn't easy. Writing this book probably took the longest. Yeah. So I did the draft, went back to the... Oh, and another thing, I did the draft. So when I did the draft for this book, I actually dictated it. So it was all dictated. And obviously we have the African accent. So a lot of that dictation, or probably about 20% of that dictated work, I had to go through again and revise because it didn't pick up what I was saying very well.
Actually,
it is what it is.
Because I know you've been telling me that I should be doing
that. Your voice would probably be better.
I don't know, just the thought of doing that, and then because I just like typing.
Yeah, it won't take the commas, the full stops, some of the other exclamation, you know. It probably won't. But it's good anyway. So if you're trying to get a story out and you haven't got access to a laptop, because we do speak faster than we type. So that was that. So the 80-20 rule. So what I did with this book is then I found, so I wrote most of it during the holidays. So when we were not marking, teaching, that's when I wrote most of the book. But it definitely took me a lot longer than the first book because I had other things to do. So, and then, like you said, I probably wrote the book for myself. So one way I can say the 80-20 works in my job right now. So as a lecturer, models to write, students to grade, and we need to do the teaching. But on top of that, we also have emails. So what I've looked at is 80% of my work. I get 80% of my results. Is that 80% of my results? Yeah, by doing 20% of the work. I wouldn't say... saying it like that makes it sound like my work is only 20%. It's not actually. It's a lot more than that. But I've divided it up. So most of my time I actually spend on delivering the materials, reading the materials, delivering. So I now spend less of my time on my emails, because emails are part of what I do, but it doesn't deliver the results that I'm checked on.
Like following on from this principle of 80-20, do you think it changes, or do you think there's fundamental things that will always work within a specific area that people should focus on? Because so what I'm trying to say is, if you establish an 80-20 for the work that you do, should you be prepared for the activities in that 80-20 to change?
It's flexibility, because it depends. It's flexibility, you know, because I've just explained my work, because even though we look at the 80-20, 80% of what I do is around the lecturing. 20% is probably the emails, but I need to concentrate on that 80%.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Do you understand? So sometimes it might not be that easy to divide it out, but most of the time, so 80% of the time, so if you look at it time-wise, 80% of the time I'm spending on the lesson plan, delivering the lectures and all that, and I'm only spending 20% on the time, 20% of the time on the emails.
Right. Yeah. So that can morph and change and stuff, but it's generally going to stay in that bucket, sure.
Yeah, because I can't say, because I definitely know that 20%, because it's definitely not the 20% that's producing the 80% results. In my case, it's probably the 80% that's producing the 80% of the results. Because the emails aren't producing results. It's just really... Probably just disgruntled.
It's a support structure for everything else, but not the... It's not the meat, it's the side dish.
So I think it would be interesting to see how that reflects in teaching. I need to give that some thought, because you definitely have to do 80% of the work. You can't do 20% and fly by that. You have to do 80%.
Well, I mentioned change just there, and I'm kind of going backwards and going back to the Unleash Your Business Mojo book. You had one chapter where you spoke about accepting change as constant.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you, what changes have you had to come to peace with that initially were difficult, but ultimately benefited you either in your in business or professionally, that you didn't expect to happen? So a change that came across, you didn't expect it to come in the way it did. You had to eventually accept it. And then in accepting it and working from there, it actually benefited you more than you could have imagined.
So one change is when I decided to start lecturing. So obviously I was running a small business at the time, coaching consultancy. I had to think about staying with that or giving it up. So I had to almost claw back. So I was doing a bit of work, but I wasn't really advertising or doing much. So that's something I had to claw back because I couldn't do both. There were too much. And one thing I did struggle with is, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm supposed to be a business owner. And now I'm going back into employment. What would people say? Can I still call myself an entrepreneur? And you kind of struggle with those things. But to be honest, it shouldn't be something you should struggle with because change is constant. You can be an entrepreneur one day and decide to be employed the next day. And I actually, the difference with me is I enjoyed what I did. I love lecturing. I love doing research. I love preparing the lesson plans. I love engaging with the students. I love, I hate grading, but I love seeing the assignments and seeing what they've been able to come up with based on the seeds that I've planted. So I love all that. So that is probably one change that made it difficult for me. But at the same time, I'm still an entrepreneur because one thing we have to understand as well, an entrepreneur is not just about starting your own business. It's about developing skills. It's about being productive. It's about being creative. It's about developing team working skills, leadership skills, coming up with new ways of dealing with problems, being critical, you know, developing your critical thinking.
Yeah.
Coming up with new ideas. Sometimes I walk into the class and I'd want to demonstrate or come up with an idea. And I thought, oh, I forgot the items. And immediately I have to think on my feet. What can I bring to the class or give them to make them understand what I'm trying to teach them? And those are entrepreneurial skills, because as an entrepreneur, you have to think on your feet. So those are probably some of the changes I've had to go through. And I enjoy what I've become. So I definitely changed over the time. Definitely changed. So being able to adapt, and obviously because changing from an account, becoming from an accountant to a business person, because my role at university now, I'm a lecturer of innovation and entrepreneurship. And this is someone coming from an accounting background. Anyway, that was easy for me to switch because I didn't enjoy the rigidity of being an accountant and what came with it. I just love this, being able to be creative.
Yeah.
So that's kind of,
yeah,
the change that I've embraced.
Yeah, you're definitely a massive, like, big picture thinker, and you always see how things can start from one place and develop into another. I think your visionary skills are like top tier.
Yeah.
Like, you can really see a vision and really like make it.
Oh, that's real. Thank you very much.
So I can see how when those changes come about and you think, okay, where can I take this?
Yeah.
There's still that big picture thinking, which is of course like a massive benefit. And yeah, definitely can be hard when, like you were saying, you know, you're changing from in your mind, you're changing from an entrepreneur to a lecturer.
Yeah.
But like you said, there's different phases in life, and as long as what you're moving into, I think, is aligned with you,
yes,
your skill set, like, because obviously your experiences as an entrepreneur are going into
Definitely.
So it's not necessarily like it's a downgrade, it's just a progression.
Yeah, it's a progression.
It's a progression, and yeah, maybe a good lesson for, I guess, all of us to take is that some, you know, every season has to come to its to its end and the next season will begin. But what's great is that we can take the things that we've got from one season into another and use that as the, you know, another place for us to I guess ultimately get fulfillment.
Yeah, because I remember
what we're doing.
And just to follow on for that, when I was teaching the MBA as well, the students reflected on that, because when I gave examples in the class, it was always based on my experience of working with other businesses. And I'm able to bring that to the class. So I'm not just a lecturer who's relied on the textbook. I can actually relate it to real life, and I'm able to give real life examples. And I think a lot of students appreciate that. So you're right in terms of the fact that even though I moved from entrepreneurship into the lecturer, I still took a lot of those skills, a lot of my knowledge and experience into that role.
So yeah, we've come to the end of the podcast.
Oh, that was cool.
Yeah. It was wow, that just flew by, didn't it? Really? That just flew by. Mum, thank you. Oh. Mum, aka Miss Mojo, as the rest of you know, thank you very much. Thank you for being on the podcast. I hope you enjoyed being on.
Yeah.
I always ask everyone who's on the podcast what they've got coming next. So it would be good to hear what you've got coming next in the pipeline, if there is, and where people can find you, the kind of work that you want them to see. So I'm just and Mum can hold that up. So
I don't know if you can see that. Two books on Amazon, so yeah.
So yeah, just this is the opportunity to plug yourself, basically.
Yeah, so obviously my name is Mojo, Miss Mojo. I've written two books, and you can find me on LinkedIn. Yeah, I'm not very active on social media these days because most of my time is taken up by work, but I will be coming back to LinkedIn. So yeah, hit me up on LinkedIn. It's Mojo Obadino. I'm also on YouTube, so I've got my own YouTube channel where I talk about business tapes and all of that thing. So Unleash Your Business Mojo is the channel. And please comment, like, share. And if you have any ideas for me for the future of what you want me to talk about, definitely hit me up. The other thing I was going to say, yeah, I've written two books. I'm happy about that. However, kudos to you, because you're writing a fictional book. And that's where I really, that's always been my dream, to write a fictional book. So kudos to you. And I would like to actually find out how you got the ideas for that.
I need to finish it first. I can't even. Sometimes I just hate, I even hate talking about it. Like, I talk about it so it's there and it's documented that it's coming. But at the same time, I'm just like, wow, it feels like I've got so long to go. But yeah, thank you, Mom. Seeing you being able to write a book had inspired me, and hearing about the challenges, even though some of them would seem daunting, it just made it more of a realistic thing in my head. So thank you for that nugget of inspiration. And yeah, when it's ready, it will be ready. Can't wait. So yeah, hope, you know, I don't even want to put a date on it necessarily, but I'm putting more ammo into it. I mean, I want this. I want this done before I'm 31. Let's just say it that way. Let's just put it that way.
Well, 31, that's old, man. You make me feel old. Anyway, thank you.
30's the new 20, Mum. 31's the new 21.
Yeah. So. I'm only 40, wow. Why are you laughing? Am I lying? Anyway, thank you very much for having me. And I just wanted to say, listen, I'm proud of you doing the podcast. You're rapping, writing a book. And on top of that, you got a first class in engineering. From Nottingham, you've been to EY. Wow, I need to be asking you, what's next for you?
we'll work that one out. But thank you, Mum. I appreciate that.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
You know, gotta please your Nigerian parents, isn't it?
Thanks for having me. Right. That's been good.
Everyone, my growth gang, that's the new name I've got for all you guys. My growth gang, thank you again for watching the podcast. Like, share, comment, subscribe, all that good stuff on YouTube, on Spotify. If you want to review it, great. Send it to some friends, all that good stuff. And I'll see you on the next podcast. Bless.